there was a lot of talk on social media and Twitter yesterday of the Northern Lights being visible in mid-Michigan last night, but I'm not sure the weather cooperated, frankly. And frankly, the temperatures were not really conducive last night to just a relaxing night of sky watching, but I was hunkered down inside most of the evening, and even a display of the Aurora Borealis was not enough to get me outside. I could barely get warm inside, let alone outside. So we hope you are getting along as we slowly emerge from the deep freeze. I now see temperatures above freezing for a number of days, as it turns out, over the weekend. You've got Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Later this hour, amongst other segments and topics, we will ask an expert about electricity choice. Who has not thought of who last month in our area did not think in terms of, is there a better way to get electricity to my house? Is there a better provider? A lot of people thought about that, and we will try to learn more with Dr. Ken Rose later this hour. At the top of the program, the Michigan legislature has begun its election year session. The body will reconsider some unfinished business from 2013, including an expansion of the Education Achievement Authority and road funding, but it will also dive into new discussions on energy and this is always interesting, how to address another budget surplus. Here to sort it out, the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, later this hour you have an expert coming on, but for now you've got me.
Okay, that's the best we could do at the top of the show. No, you're going to do just fine.
I'm so nervous.
I need to ask you about the Andy Dillon situation, because this is creating quite a stir. He's still on the payroll at the salary he was at when he was Secretary of the Treasury.
Well, the treasurer. We don't have a secretary.
The state treasurer. I beg your pardon. I was thinking federally there for a second.
Yeah. That's right. But, it came as a surprise that the political newsletter MERS News actually found his name on a list of unclassified, which means not covered by civil service employees, and sort of did a what gives, and then everyone jumped on it. And, it turned out to be kind of a surprise. This is not actually the first time that a State Department director, at least under the Snyder administration, you know, has left and then remained on as basically, you know, an advisor, a consultant at more or less the same salary. But the circumstances were unusual, that in this case there weren't really plans for Andy Dillon to move on last November, except that he was at the tail end of a very messy divorce with a vindictive, to put it mildly, ex-spouse who was continuing to hammer him, you know, as long as he was in the spotlight. And so a decision was made on his part, maybe on the administration's part, to move him out of the spotlight. And apparently, you know, but he's still been there doing a lot of the same things as the state makes the transition to a new treasurer. And it sort of makes sense because, you know, he's involved in a lot of things, the Detroit bankruptcy, you know, the emergency manager law, and you know, all of those cities and school districts that are facing the sort of fiscal hardship that could wind up with some form of state control. There was just a whole lot going on there. They just weren't very upfront about it. There were sort of some, you know, nods at the time that, you know, Andy Dillon was going to assist in the transition. No one said that he was going to remain on the payroll at his salary for an indeterminate period of time. And now they're saying that it'll be, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. And, you know, it gave Democrats plenty to jump about, that, you know, the state Democratic Party chair Lon Johnson put out a statement that this was, you know, an example of cronyism or crony capitalism. But, you know, anytime you can, you know, work the word crony into, you know, one of your criticisms, you know, you really can't pass up the opportunity. I'll bet Andy Dillon goes to Detroit for crony dogs.
Okay.
His favorite rock song is Crony Crony.
Okay. It's an election year, which you may recall. How is that likely to impact what gets done at the legislature between now and November?
Well, beyond the proliferation of wedge issues that we'll see introduced in the legislature, it shrinks the time period to get things done. Before, everyone just wants to, exit Lansing to get home to campaign, but also before just, the heat of political campaigning overwhelms everything. So that's how the election year will probably affect things.
But what does that say about what will actually get done between now and, say, the end of May?
That the governor and the legislature have to move quickly if they're going to deal with the things that they want to deal with. Is that, the governor would still like to see something done about road funding, which at this juncture seems quite unlikely that he would like to see something done about auto no-fault and the cost of auto insurance. And at this juncture, that seems unlikely just because of the controversy and complexity of those topics. In the case of road funding, it's also a tax increase. And really, everyone right now is focused on that wonderful budget surplus that it looks like when you combine the general fund and the school aid fund, it'll be somewhere around $1 billion. We'll find out tomorrow when a panel convenes at the state capitol for the revenue estimating conference.
It's a pretty big deal.
More fun than a rock and roll show.
Yeah. How have you looked ahead here and given any thought to how these excess funds are likely to get earmarked?
Well, there is a as you could imagine, that there are more ideas on how to spend it than there is money to spend, even if it is more than $1 billion. But there's also, there's a lot of talk, first of all, of tax cuts.
Right.
And that discussion about if we even go down that road, should it be across the board in the form of something like a reduction in the income tax rate, or should it be targeted in the form of, say, restoring the earned income tax credit or restoring the tax exemption for pension income, which, by the way, was also very controversial. And if you're a Democrat, it appears to be a pretty effective wedge issue that you can use against Republicans. By the way, the governor who put a lot on the line to get the income tax extended to pensions has basically tried to take it off the table. He says that's a non-starter because that was a matter of tax fairness, that pension income should not be treated any differently than, say, 401k income, and that share shouldn't be shifted to other taxpayers, including the young families that you'd like to see located in Michigan. So there's that fight over tax cuts. But first, you've got to have the discussion about whether we should go down that road anyway. Do you want to give people what would really be, a pretty modest amount of tax breaks or tax, quote unquote, relief, when maybe you could use it for other things? The state still hasn't made its targets. It's just a little bit more than halfway to the $1.2 billion that it would like to have in its rainy day savings accounts, which would also improve its credit rating and reduce the costs of borrowing. That
and the Snyder administration's rather fond of beefing up the rainy day fund.
Absolutely, we will not get through this budget year without putting more money into that. That's how they're devoted to it. Maybe there's another example, of some long-term debt that could be paid down. Maybe there are investments that you want to make in roads or public transportation, something to do with schools. It's an election year, and in the same way that no one suffers from cutting, politicians never suffer from cutting taxes in an election year, they don't suffer from putting more money into schools either.
Have the Democrats, though, taken a cut in, say, the state income tax off the table? I mean, are they receptive to that idea at all?
They'll probably, it depends on which Democrats you talk to. But, this is going to be a year where, from the federal level on down, that Democrats are going to try to make income inequality a political issue. which means that when, you know, you look at, for example, a reduction in the state income tax rate, that means that more of the benefit goes to people who have larger incomes.
Right.
So, you know, Democrats, you would expect, would look at a narrower approach. So, you know, things like, exemptions that deal with your house or, something that's targeted lower income people.
Gotcha.
You know, we'll hear middle-class families a lot this year.
The governor and other Republicans have been supportive of expanding early childhood education spending, and Mr. Snyder, I take it, also wants to increase state spending on universities, which have taken significant hits in recent years. What kind of debate on education do you anticipate?
Well, I think that the debate will be how much you put back into K-12 and universities, and not whether you do, and whether or not you
he's
can.
Already restored some of those,
mm-hmm.
right?
And when we talked last year, he said that he would like to get universities back to where they were at least when he took office, because in his first year that he had to make a pretty significant cut to higher education, to public universities.
You would expect that to happen then?
I would expect an increase, whether or not it gets to there, and whether or not the issue that universities have is that their expenses are actually rising faster than the rate of inflation, which means that obviously even an inflationary increase isn't actually an increase in what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And, an inflationary increase is still in terms of, value, a reduction.
They're still playing catch-up. Would more aid to universities be a part of a bargain to hold down tuition or university salaries? Because we traveled that road not too long ago.
I can't imagine that tuition would not be part of the discussion, especially in an election year.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, after we've seen universities now starting to, blast through the tuition caps, because the message that they're trying to send back to Lansing is that if you're not going to give us the increases that we need, then we're going to make it up in tuition and just take your sanctions.
What about spending on municipalities? Cities, of course, feeling the pinch from the state's elimination of the personal property tax.
Mm-hmm.
Are they apt to see any relief here this year?
Well, local governments are there's going to be a question on the ballot on that this year. And local governments say that it could still cost them a lot of money. And so they're working with Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly to come up with, basically a fix for that beforehand, so we'll see how it goes.
Give us more context there. What is going to be on the ballot?
A question regarding the personal property tax and replacement revenue, and local governments just say, it's not enough. I should point out, that Governor Snyder and Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero did a walkthrough at a road crew station earlier this week just to thank the people for, clearing the streets and to, let the public know that they were on the job. And the mayor, made a point of just mentioning to the governor that a little more money to help local governments do their work this year.
That was an opportunity,
would be welcome, yeah.
Mayor Bernera could not pass out. But when the personal property tax was passed, this was baked in the cake. This was going to go mm-hmm. to the voters all along, and the legislature did sign on to replacing that revenue. That mm-hmm. that is what you're referring to. So now, is the legislature likely to give municipalities more options for raising their own revenue? I know that idea is in circulation.
That idea is, and the controversy about that is that it creates winners and losers. Wealthier areas are more able to take advantage of something like that, but that doesn't really help the urban centers, less wealthy rural areas. And so that's not just a broad-based solution to whatever it is that you're trying to deal with. Some issues that will come up, just you know, since we're listing them, is we'll hear, you know, the House Republicans are going to unveil their agenda. And, you know, if there's any player in Lansing who's, you know, shown that he's capable of moving stuff through the process, it's House Speaker Jace Bulger. They want to do school safety and gun rights, which means that we'll probably be revisiting that whole issue of, you know, one, where people can carry concealed pistols, but also whether you know, schools should or should not be part of it, and there's an ambiguity in the law about that. You know, we'll hear about the tax, you know, the whole issue of what we should do about tax cuts and individual tax relief. We will not hear about a whole lot for businesses like we did in the first year of the Snyder administration. Human trafficking will come up. That's been a priority going into 2014. So some things like that, and gun rights, you know, like I said before, where you can carry firearms.
You alluded to auto no-fault reform earlier. Contrary to the governor's wishes, the auto no-fault languished last year.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Snyder and his allies alleged the state's uncapped payouts to accident victims make premiums unaffordable and make it too expensive to live here, especially in the city of Detroit. Any chance of movement there?
Well, we'll see. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some unique ideas about what to do about urban insurance rates, you know, maybe even something that's a little more Detroit specific. But, you know, Governor Snyder said last year that he's open to trying to find a fix without getting to the, you know, capping medical benefits, because that's really been what's been stopping this train, that there just isn't enough support among the Republican majorities to do that. And that is because there is not really support in the public in Michigan to do something about Michigan's unique unlimited medical benefits for mm-hmm. accident victims. And so that's, you know, that's the thicket that they've got to cut through if they're going to make that happen.
Do you expect, this is the year that the legislature is also scheduled to take up Michigan's energy future, the renewable portfolio standard, electric choice, mm-hmm. and on. In general, what do you anticipate out of that debate?
Well, what the governor said he wants, that, you know, he released an energy report last year that was pretty spare on details. But, you know, sort of the big picture message was that we should make sure that we're flexible. And I don't think that flexible means mandates, but that what they want, what the governor wants, and what the Public Service Commission wants is a system where we can move pretty easily between energy sources, whether it's natural gas, if solar becomes more affordable, you know, maybe that, wind power. And there's always the controversy over, you know, so-called clean coal, which is, you know, what you do if you're building, you know, what are called baseload power plants, the ones that really supply a lot of electricity to a lot of homes and businesses. And that's a huge environmental controversy. Environmentalists say, of course, clean coal is a misnomer.
But in an election year, do you expect a lot of movement on defining Michigan's energy future, or will a lot of this be put off, do you think?
I think that that's going to be a pretty complex topic to tackle before we get consumed with elections. That doesn't mean it's impossible, but I would, you know, personally, I'd peg it at 50-50. And of course, a lot of this stuff, you know, may just hang fire until after the elections in the lame duck session.
Rick Pluta and his colleague Jake Neer cover the state capitol for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, have a great day. Thank you.
You too.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for being with us. Last summer, hundreds of thousands of people from around the world volunteered to take part in the first human expedition to Mars. The project, titled Mars One, provides a one-way ticket to the Red Planet for four finalists who will form the first human colony on the planet. Last week, the potential space explorers were narrowed down from over 200,000 to about 1,000, and Michigan native Erica Mazeros, who Current State spoke with in September, made it through the elimination round. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Mazeros shortly after she heard the news. Erica said after receiving an email from Mars One, it was not initially a joyous celebration.
Due to a fluke, I got both a rejection and an acceptance letter. It was a bug in their mail system where, because I had changed my email address with them, they sent a rejection letter to my old email address and then the correct acceptance letter to my new one. And I verified it with Bass himself that I have actually been accepted. But initially, I got the rejection letter, and I was pretty heartbroken. It was really sad, and I sent a text to my husband saying, well, I don't get to move forward. This is pretty awful. And I dealt with that for about 15 minutes, and then I got the acceptance one, and I was like, oh, is this actually true? This is one of those things that you dream about when you get the initial rejection letter, like, well, maybe this is a mistake. But now that I know for sure I have actually made it to the next round, it's really exciting. That's the biggest emotion that I feel, excitement.
What was your husband's reaction? You said you sent him a text after you got the rejection, and then you said talk to him after you got accepted. I mean, how does he feel about this?
He's been just amazingly supportive through the whole thing. He didn't seem overly excited about me being rejected, so I think he really is hoping for me to continue on and meet my dreams and goals. So I think he's excited for me as well.
So what are the next steps in this process? It's been narrowed down from over 200,000 applicants to just over 1,000. What comes next for you guys?
Well, this round, I think, has two parts in it. And the first part is physical examination. So they need to make sure that we're all physically and mentally capable of moving on, and handling the pressures that Mars brings. But it's also, we're all calling it the interview stage, because this is going to be about us interviewing with people and staff from Mars One so that they can actually meet us face-to-face and find out if we are everything we presented ourselves to be to the world.
Do you have an interview strategy? I mean, if I ask you right now, why do you think you should be selected to go on this mission? What do you say to that?
Well, I've always said that my biggest asset is my ability to learn things well and learn them quickly. And I think that my interview strategy would be to show that to the Mars One staff, that I can pick up new things, I can adapt to new situations, I can handle myself well under pressure, under stress. I can show that to them, then I think that I really stand a chance of moving on to round three.
So this is just the first step in the process. I guess, do you know what skills you guys are going to be required to learn as the training process goes on?
Well, I don't know what skills, but there are sets of skills that I hope we learn and sets of skills that I imagine we'd have to learn, and then there are documented sets of skills that astronauts before us have had to learn, right? There are all those montages in things like, Apollo 13, where you see astronauts training and what they have to go through. So I imagine we'd go through similar training processes. I imagine we'd have to go through a lot of physical training and becoming stronger to handle everything that's going to get thrown at us. But also a lot of isolation exercises as well. We'd be up there a long time with just the group of us that would be going. So I think psychologically there's a lot to prepare for there as well. But I also hope that we'd be learning a lot of physics to prepare for this. I mean, we're all going to be bringing different skills to the table, obviously, but I hope we do get to go back and get some coursework out of this too.
How does it feel to know now that, you're one of just over 1,000 people who have this opportunity?
Really exciting. I thought maybe that moving on to the next round would make it a little scarier, a little more real. And while it definitely has become more real, a lot of the fear has dissipated, and it's been replaced with excitement. This is something big that I'm a part of, and I'm just really excited to have moved on to this round.
So there's not more hesitation, but more, I guess, willingness at this point?
Exactly. A lot of the hesitation has kind of melted away and been replaced with, wow, you know, I really can reach these dreams that I've had ever since I was a kid. This is real. This could really happen.
So you're leaving behind potentially, you know, your entire life if you are selected to be one of the few finalists as you guys, more and more of you are cut. And you're leaving behind a husband, family. And I know we've talked about this before, Erica, but can just remind me and remind our listeners why you think it's so important to be part of this expedition to Mars?
Well, humankind has always faced itself on exploration and adventure. I mean, that's always been part of the human spirit. It's always been part of who we are as a race, and it's always been part of our identity. And now that globalization has allowed us to explore more and more of the globe, I think what's next for us is to reach out into space. And that brings us a lot medically, scientifically. It brings us a lot of answers, a lot of technologies. It offers us a lot that can benefit us as a race, but it also offers us a lot mentally, just to reach out there into the unexplored, into the places that we've never been, just to explore for the sake of exploration. I think there's nothing more human than that.
Erica Mazaris is a Ypsilanti native. She's one of 1,058 finalists selected from over 200,000 applicants for the Mars One mission. Mars One hopes to send a group of four on a one-way trip to Mars by 2023. I think that's the date at this point. In the long run, hoping to create a human settlement on the red planet. Erica, as always, it's a pleasure, and I'm sure we'll be checking in with you as your journey continues.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure talking with you as well.
Tomorrow on Current State here on WKAR, we will talk with the newly announced head of the Independent Community Review Team that will look into the Board of Water and Light operations here during the recent ice storm. We welcome General Michael McDaniel to Current State tomorrow. So make note of that. The University of Michigan hospitals and health centers have recently had hundreds of people needing emergency treatment for the flu. MLive reporter Amy Biacchini reported that some patients wound up on life support with H1N1, which reached pandemic levels back in 2009. Most had not been vaccinated, and some had been transferred to Ann Arbor from other parts of Michigan, along with Ohio and Indiana, by the way. Joining us to bring us up to speed on H1N1 here in Michigan is MSU University physician Dr. Beth Alexander. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning.
H1N1 can cause respiratory failure, kidney failure, and septic shock. Why is H1N1 so much more dangerous than other flu strains?
Well, I think you have to take the wider context, which is how the country and the states collect reporting data. And the data that we have at any one point in time, particularly early in the flu season, is collected from 11 hospitals throughout the state, and it doesn't give us the entire picture. So far, University of Michigan has had a disproportionate number of seriously ill people from H1N1 because they have equipment and technology that most hospitals do not have that help very critically ill patients survive.
So the worst cases go there, and we're learning about them.
Correct.
Okay.
There are other cases, and now at least 130 or 140 hospitalizations, although the data are usually about 2 weeks behind because of the collection process, the holidays, the recent weather challenges we've had. But generally, they're at least a week behind.
And how many of these people who are in serious condition with H1N1 is the prognosis good for them generally, or is it more dire than that?
When people get any strain of flu, but particularly H1N1, there are those who can benefit from the antiviral medication early in the course of the disease, and then having access to adequate life support, cutting technology, life support, caregivers, and equipment. will increase the chance of survival. The ones who get critically ill are generally in any flu season, people who have some other weaknesses or impairment, lung disease or cardiovascular disease or smokers, mm-hmm. or very young children are also susceptible. H1N1 does appear to be a bit more aggressive than some, and it's affecting a younger age group than typically we see with flu.
Are people who got flu shots protected from H1N1?
Most of the flu shots this year included H1N1. If people got their flu shot and aren't sure, they can ask their providers whether they got the one that included H1N1, but almost all of them included that. And many people were vaccinated in 2009 also when the H1N1 epidemic occurred.
And that would still provide some protection,
yes.
5 years later?
Yes.
The H1N1 outbreak in 09 was described as a pandemic. Can you briefly remind our listeners what a pandemic is?
A pandemic is a infectious disease that affects the entire globe, whereas epidemics are more localized.
Okay. And why did cases of H1N1 decline between then and this current outbreak? Why might these numbers be up now? Is it related to vaccination rates, or are there other factors?
Well, certainly it relates to vaccination rates, because the very most important thing people can do is become vaccinated every year with the current flu vaccines. And the people who monitor flu viruses all over the world make the best predictions they can about what strains need to be included in the vaccines. This year it appears they guessed it correctly, because the vast majority of flu that we're seeing so far in the season is H1N1.
Are you seeing a lot in East Lansing or the Lansing area?
Some. Not excessive numbers of hospitalizations, but lots of ER visits and urgent care visits and primary care visits, mm-hmm. For people who have respiratory illness.
You alluded earlier to some of the treatment that people can get. Is treating H1N1 earlier as opposed to later an important factor in getting through it?
For some people, yes. There are specific recommendations about who should be treated early in the course of a flu illness that are put out by the CDC, which is our best resource for public health. And it's a guidance to physicians about who ought to be considered for early treatment. And it's a fairly large group of people. It's people with compromised immune systems, the extreme elderly, very young children, people with any kind of pulmonary disease, people on chemotherapy or immunosuppressant drugs, those groups, it's recommended that they be treated early.
How concerned are you about an H1N1 outbreak on the Michigan State campus?
Well, I'm concerned enough that we've pushed hard to educate people and encourage them to be vaccinated, because that's really the most important thing people can do. And in addition, the usual preventive things for respiratory viruses, which are good hand washing, taking care of your general health through diet and exercise and so forth.
So it's not too late to get a flu shot.
It is not. The flu shot becomes fully effective about 2 weeks after one gets it, but it's not too late. We're early in the flu season. It's just starting to really rise. So although the news has illustrated the somewhat dramatic cases in eastern Michigan, there will be more. Mm. And most of the people who are affected have been people who were not vaccinated.
Is H1N1 especially contagious?
No more so than other flu viruses.
Okay. And how long is a patient contagious who has the flu virus?
Well, that's a little hard for me to precisely quantify, but it's generally as long as you're coughing, sneezing, have fever, and are ill, one should consider themselves contagious. But the diagnosis of flu is a specific diagnosis, and many people with flu-like symptoms may not know whether they actually have the flu or some other respiratory virus.
We're talking with MSU University physician Dr. Beth Alexander about H1N1 and specifically about the number of cases here that have shot up in the state of Michigan. Can you tell us more about the treatment that might be necessary for a patient with H1N1? How are they treated?
First, it's symptomatic, which is ibuprofen or aspirin or Tylenol to take care of the aches and fever, and then rest and lots of fluids. And for generally healthy people, that's the treatment that's recommended. For the groups that have other underlying illness, there are a couple of specific antiviral drugs, and people may remember the trade name of Tamiflu. There are two drugs in that category that for certain people with certain illnesses, they are recommended as early as possible when we believe they have a influenza illness.
Are the symptoms of H1N1, they're similar to just about any number of different kinds of flu then?
Correct.
Okay. Now, the BBC had reported that the first H5N1 bird flu death in North America, a resident of Alberta, Canada, who had recently traveled to Beijing. Is there any chance that you're aware of H5N1 striking Michigan?
Right. That case was just identified in Alberta, and the thinking about it is that the patient contracted the disease when they were traveling in China, where the disease among animals, particularly birds, is endemic in some areas of China. And the patient actually contracted the virus there. Right now, that virus, H5N1, which is particularly serious, does not appear to be transmissible between people for the most part. So I don't think there's, at this point, a lot of reason for being concerned about that other than for the welfare of the person who got ill.
Very good. Well, this has been very enlightening. We appreciate your time. MSU University physician Dr. Beth Alexander, thank you.
Thank you.
State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. In most marketplaces, if we, the customers, aren't happy with the product or service we've paid for, we can look at the other competitors and choose another option. If Ford sells you a lemon, next time you could go to buy a car, perhaps you'll be looking at GM models or a Chrysler or, God forbid, a foreign car. But in the complex utility marketplace, things are not that simple. The extended power outage and subsequent public relations missteps by the Lansing Board of Water and Light have no doubt left some angry customers wondering how they might be able to switch electricity providers. Here to help us wade through the answer is Ken Rose. Ken is a senior fellow at MSU's Institute for Public Utilities and a nationally recognized expert in electricity market restructuring. He joins us by phone from his home in Chicago. Ken, welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the question's pretty simple. However, in the Byzantine world of utilities, I can't imagine it's an easy answer, but we'll give it a try. If some customers are angry at the electric company for not restoring their power in a timely fashion and they want to switch companies, how difficult would that be?
Well, people have probably heard about switching to a different supplier for their electricity. And a number of states, 13 states and the District of Columbia, allow residential customers to choose their own electric supplier. But you don't choose your own utility. The utility business is really divided up into three main components. There's the generation side of the business that's supplying the kilowatt hours. That's the part that is in some areas, you have the ability to choose a different supplier. In Michigan, it's limited to 10% of the utility's load. Then you have the distribution part of the business. That's the wires that run behind people's houses and takes the power to the meter and into the house. And then there's the transmission side. That's the big power lines that you see out in, when you're driving down the highway. And so you have it in some of these areas, you have a choice of who's going to supply the electricity, but you don't always have a choice of who your utility supplier is going to be, unless you happen to live like right near a border where you can put a new power line. And there's kind of a practical reason for that, because otherwise you'd have to have duplicate power lines running to people's houses if they were going to have a different supplier. So typically what happens is there's a franchise that's granted to a utility to serve a given area. If it's a private company, it's usually regulated by the state, or it's a municipal utility like what Lansing has that's run by the city.
So we're debating here in Michigan whether to have more energy choice or competition in our energy market. Would more energy choice in the generation, as you say, the generation of the electricity, would that make a difference when it comes to which company services the lines or repairs damage during outages?
No. If you had the choice of electric supplier and just assume you pick somebody other than your utility, if another ice storm comes along and takes out the lines around your house, you're not going to get electricity from anybody because that's being supplied by the distribution utility. Now, sometimes people want to change the ownership style of the utility. So what typically happens if there's a crisis like what happened in Lansing, people are always looking at the alternative models to what they have. So recently, as you know, there was that hurricane that went through New York City, Hurricane Sandy. And that flooded the system, took out power. People were without power for a week or more. And so they were looking to replace their investor-owned utility with a municipalized system. And the idea being that would be more responsive to the citizenry. In Lansing, I understand the debate now is going the other way. Well, maybe we need a private company because the municipal utility didn't do such a good job.
Right.
The problem is, when something that broad happens, it's difficult for any style of utility to really manage a crisis like that because they don't have the people nearby that can really deal with something that's so massive and such a massive scale. They really rely on neighboring utilities to help out. Well, it wasn't just Lansing, of course, that was affected. It went through a big chunk of central Michigan, so the neighboring utilities were busy with their own systems. And I've recently heard now, there was a headline that the Public Service Commission of Michigan is looking into DTE and consumers' responses to the ice storm, which is typical after something like that happens. But they obviously had their own crisis to deal with, so you have to call on utilities even farther away, and it may take days for them to get there, assuming they're not dealing with their own problems. So,
and there are contracts that exist between, say, the Lansing Board of Water and Light and backup crews, backup companies that might aid us in the event of an emergency.
Right. They have arrangements usually with neighboring utilities, and sometimes utilities in a big crisis will come from several states away to help out.
Oh, that's happened several times already.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And but it takes days for that help to get there, and no utility in the country probably has the kind of excess capacity, linemen and others, and the bucket trucks and all the equipment that they need to deal with this, to be able to handle something where 40% or so of the customers have been taken out by something like an ice storm.
You're not painting a real encouraging picture for people who are really craving choice here, it seems.
Well, whether or not Michigan should go to full retail choice for all retail customers, that's a separate debate. That's a debate about, whether or not that's been working very well in other states. Have customers benefited from that? I think the jury is still out on that, but that's a separate debate about whether or not competition and whether or not competition can develop for something like utility service. That's separate from making sure that your distribution utility is responsive to crisis and, you know, maybe how they can do things better in the future.
Our guest this morning on Current State is Ken Rose. Ken's a senior fellow at MSU's Institute for Public Utilities and a nationally recognized expert in electricity market restructuring. And we're talking about electric choice here primarily with Ken. How common are municipally owned utilities?
There are about 2,000 municipally owned utilities in the country. They typically serve smaller cities and towns. They usually have a board of some sort that oversees the utility, and they're also answerable to the city council or whatever political arrangement is in the area. So it's basically owned by the city, and they're pretty common for the, like I said, smaller cities and towns. Most of them typically don't own a lot of their own generation. They buy power often from investor-owned utilities. So the two big investor-owned utilities in Michigan are DTE, and that serves the Detroit area and outside Detroit and other parts of Michigan, and then consumers are investor-owned utilities, and those you can buy stock in, and they're owned by the shareholders.
Well, speaking from 5 miles up, Ken, does one or the other tend to be more responsive to their customers' needs?
Well, I think what happens, you know, when there's a crisis, people always want to look at the other model. You could argue that the municipal utilities are more responsive to the citizenry because it's basically the city or town that owns it, and they have a board made up usually of people that live within that area. And they're overseeing a lot of aspects of the utility, not, you know, just its response to a crisis, but things like the prices and the power projects that they have, line projects, things like that. And in the case of the investor-owned utility, the argument is that the profit motive is a better motivator. But those typically are regulated by the state, the state public utility or public service commission. And so, if there's any kind of a disruption of service, they get investigated by the regulator. Of course, the regulator then is usually those are appointed by the governor. So either way, you still have some kind of a chain that goes back to the citizenry that have are able to respond to some kind of a disruption of service. You could argue the municipal utilities may be a little closer to the people who live there, and generally they do a very good job in those areas that they serve. I think most people are usually happy with their service. It's just that crises occur and then people start looking around for different models.
Thinking more about long-term investments, Ken, I wanted to get your thoughts on a couple of other ideas being talked about. What do you make of smart grid technology?
Well, the smart grid is really kind of a general term that's used to speak about a lot of different things, you know, things like the smart meters that some people may have attached to their house, better communications with the technologies not only within the house but all the way back to the utility. And there's one aspect of smart grid that's talked about that may be helpful in a crisis, which is better communication when there's outages so that the utility knows immediately when there's been a disruption of service for a customer. A lot of people probably don't realize it, but when the lights go out, typically the utility doesn't know. If you have a regular meter on the house, the utility doesn't know that you're out until you call them, and or your neighbors have called them. Then they can kind of figure out that something's going on. Some of the smart grid aspects, or smart meters, for example, would tell the utility immediately when something went out. Now, I'm not sure how much this would have helped in this case, because with all the power going out, a lot of this obviously is dependent on having power in those areas, or at least backup power. And also the communication systems get disrupted. If they use phone lines or cell towers go down, you don't have you lose the communication that you're really betting on. Now, maybe it works fine when, say, one block goes out, but when you have 40% of the customers going out, it's going to be a bigger problem.
There's a fair amount of discussion of burying electrical lines here in the Lansing area as well. How feasible would it be to bury these lines?
Well, as you know, probably if you live in a newer area, it's typical for them to put the lines underground right away for the in the distribution system. To do it in an existing area, though, can be costly. You have to go by where people, there are buildings, you have to dig the trenches, you have to bury the lines, move the lines down below, so it can be pretty expensive. And that's not exactly a 100% guarantee that that isn't subject to disruption. That can also, they can be flooded, and they can have, people can be digging where they shouldn't be digging with their developers maybe could be stick a backhoe and take out hundreds of customers. That happens too, so it's not a complete foolproof way, and it is expensive.
Hey, how closely have you been following the local BWL drama, Ken? I mean, any thoughts on how this is playing out?
Well, you know, it plays out typically. I have seen a little bit about it. It seems to me that the investigations go forward. People are obviously upset early on, as understandably. I've been without power. It's happened to me where I was without for about 4.5 days. It's not a lot of fun, and you kind of wonder, and you tend to feel alone even if other people are out with you. So those investigations, I think, are a good thing. It'd be good for the utility in the long run, for them maybe to have to be more responsive in the future if something like that happens again. You know, something like the good news is something that disruptive only happens once every 20 or 30 years or more. It's okay. It's not a common experience. So
we've got to let it go there, Ken. We appreciate your time very much.
Sure.
Great discussion. Ken Rose is an independent consultant based in Chicago and a senior fellow at MSU's Institute for Public Utilities, who specializes in electricity market restructuring. Thanks for joining us, Ken.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow on Current State on WKAR, we talk with the newly announced head of the independent community review team involving the Board of Water and Light. That's General Michael McDaniel. That's our show for today. Also tomorrow, the Army Corps of Engineers this week released their long-awaited report detailing options to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. We'll break down the findings with Great Lakes journalist Gary Wilson. Live jazz tomorrow, too, from the Michigan Jazz Trail. It's Current State, 90.5 WKAR. Have a good day.